June 2017 will mark the 50th anniversary of the 1967 Six-Day War, a half century since the beginning of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories. Some believe that the two-state solution, Israel and Palestine, has now become impossible, but former Senator and Special Envoy for Middle East Peace, George Mitchell, argues for a renewed effort in a book called A Path to Peace, A Brief History of the Israeli-Palestinian Negotiations and a Way Forward in the Middle East. It's co-authored with Alon Sachar and published by Simon & Schuster. I'm very pleased it has brought George Mitchell back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's nice of you to have me.
You were here in June last year to discuss your memoir, The Negotiator. Have prospects for peace between Israelis and Palestinians or for a two-state solution changed significantly in that year and a half?
Not significantly, but I think it would be fair to say that the prospects are not great right now. There is not any reason for optimism, but I believe that it's in the interests of both societies, so much so that they will ultimately come to agree.
And why have some become more pessimistic about the possibility of a Palestinian state?
Both societies are moving away from the two-state solution. Within Israeli society, the government now includes many party officials who are outspokenly and adamantly against there ever being a Palestinian state on the West Bank. On the Palestinian side, there is growing impatience with the policies of President Abbas, who for 25 years has opposed violence against Israel, has recognized Israel and has said that the way forward is through peaceful negotiation, hasn't gotten anywhere, and so there's declining support for him and for that policy.
Are they leaning more toward Hamas?
Hamas controls Gaza, has done a very poor job there, as we know. I think that people are frustrated generally. I don't think there is much pro-Hamas as disappointed in the lack of progress under the Palestinian Authority.
I've spoken to a number of Israelis who say that the country is still split almost 50-50 as to whether there should be a two-state solution. Used to be more of a majority, but still 50-50 would suggest that negotiations are possible. Do any Palestinians advocate a solution other than the two-state approach?
Well, yes, of course. Hamas takes the position that it won't recognize Israel, won't agree to give up the armed struggle, and won't commit to honoring prior agreements. Those are the conditions that the quartet created by the U.S., but including the U.S., the European Union, Russia, and the U.N., have established for Hamas participation in the process. So there's strong disagreement there. On the Israeli side, as you pointed out, there is substantial support remaining for a two-state solution. And our book, Alone and I, is essentially an argument for keeping that as the objective because the alternatives are less feasible, less likely to succeed.
Jimmy Carter has an op-ed in today's New York Times urging the Obama administration to, quote, grant American diplomatic recognition to the state of Palestine as 137 countries have already done. What would that accomplish?
I have great respect for President Carter, and he made a major contribution to peace in the region by brokering the Israel-Egypt peace agreement at Camp David. But I don't agree with this recommendation at this time. It is true that 137 countries have recognized Palestine, but the United States is not just one of 138. The United States is the dominant power in the world. It will be the decisive factor in the region. And if there is to be an agreement, it must be through and with the leadership of the United States government. So American policy for many decades has been that these issues, a state for Palestine and security for the people of Israel, and the specifics of them, Jerusalem, refugees, and so forth, should be left to direct negotiations between the parties. And I believe that's still to be the case. I think that's the way to get a Palestinian state, in fact, as opposed to one just in name.
Haven't you recommended that President Obama set forth his views on Israel Israeli-Palestinian relations before he leaves office. Do you have any specific recommendations on what he should say?
Yes, the book does make some recommendations in that regard.
He doesn't have much time.
He doesn't have much time, but President Clinton made his speech just about a week before leaving office, so there's still that much and more time. We think he ought to provide general parameters without trying to prescribe every single issue in detail.
Well, President Clinton saw resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as something, as his legacy, and it didn't work.
It didn't work, and President Trump will be the 13th American president to try his hand at this issue, and whoever he chooses as Secretary of State will be the 21st American Secretary of State. So there's a long line of predecessors who've tried but not succeeded, but the effort builds on itself, and you can't take the first 5, 10, or 20 no's as the final answer, particularly when you're talking about the pursuit of peace.
President Obama has approved $38 billion in military aid to Israel over the next 10 years. What will that have? What effect will that have on the current situation and the occupation?
It will enable Israel to maintain its qualitative military edge over any other country or conceivable grouping of countries in the region, which is a firm and unbreakable commitment by the United States to the people of Israel. At the same time, we believe that the best interests of Israel would be served by the creation of a independent, sovereign, non-militarized Palestinian state. That's the way Israel can get security for their people. That's the way Palestinians can get a state. In January of 2008, President George W. Bush traveled to Jerusalem and made a powerful speech to both Israelis and Palestinians in which he essentially made the argument I just stated. He described to them both how they are vested in each other's success because that's the only way they can get what they want. That's American policy. I believe in it, and I think it will ultimately succeed.
How much and what kind of aid is the United States giving to the Palestinians?
We provide substantial financial assistance to the Palestinians. Over the past decade, it's probably been $1.5 billion or so. It's not nearly as much as we provide to Israel, but it is substantial. And it is very meaningful to the Palestinians. Aid also comes from the European Union, individual European countries, and a number of Arab countries.
I'm speaking with George J. Mitchell, who, with Alon Zahar, has written a book called The Path to Peace, A Brief History of Israeli-Palestinian Negotiations and the Way Forward in the Middle East. It is published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Why did you collaborate with Alon Zahar on this book?
Alon Zahar is a brilliant young man. He was a State Department employee when I was appointed by President Obama as Middle East envoy. He has spent years working in Jerusalem and in the Middle East. He is a recognized expert on Israeli law, including Israeli land law. He left the government after I left, went to Stanford Law School, now practices law in San Francisco. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of the history of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations and Israeli land laws and settlement policies.
We talked about some suggestions you might have had for President Obama. You earlier, of course, had advised Bill Clinton. Do you have any suggestions for Donald Trump going forward?
Well, we wrote this book before the election. So we did not know who the president would be, and we do have recommendations in there that we hope that the president-elect will first adopt the two-state solution as the continuing objective of the United States and pursue it vigorously with both sides, as previous presidents have done, and let us hope and pray that he is successful where others were not.
Didn't both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton take positions that were largely in line with the government of Benjamin Netanyahu? Last March, in a speech at AIPAC, Hillary Clinton condemned Bernie Sanders for promising to be neutral on Israel and Palestine.
Well, every candidate for president, just about, and certainly every president-elect, has made statements of U.S. support for Israel, and that goes back to the very founding. Harry Truman was the president who recognized the state of Israel 11 minutes after David Ben-Gurion pronounced it in Jerusalem.
So Israel, did the Soviet Union recognize it right away, but
a little after
the world changes.
A little after us. But we have a firm and unbreakable commitment toward Israel for its security. And at the same time, American policy supports the creation of a Palestinian state so that they may have the dignity that comes with self-governance, and it will be better for both if they do it.
What are we hearing from the Palestinians and the Israelis about the election?
I only know what I've read in the papers. Prime Minister Netanyahu is very pleased with the outcome. Members of his party have been outspoken in their support, members of his government, in what they think it means to giving them a free hand in settlements in other areas.
He also said that he would move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem.
So have many, many candidates for president and presidents-elect in the past. And on taking office and after reflection, they have decided to defer waiting for negotiations and an agreement. It may happen. So long as it preserves the option in some way of there being a Palestinian capital in some part of Jerusalem, primarily the Palestinian inhabited areas, we'll survive it. But I think it would be a reversal of American policy over many decades to leave these issues to final status negotiations between the parties.
What impact have demographics had on this situation? The Israeli settlements are partly because Israel has a growing population. At the same time, Palestinians will form a majority of the population west of the Jordan River if they don't already. So won't there just be a real pressure on both sides?
It's more than that. I have argued to successive Israeli leaders that the demographics are daunting for them, and that it is not in the interest of the people of Israel to have a continued state of conflict, the absence of normal relations with all of their neighbors in the region. They, in fact, have common goals with Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf Arabs in resisting Iran's drive for hegemony in the region. And the demographics, both specifically and more general, are daunting. Let me cite them. There are now a slight majority of Jews in the area between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. But when you combine the birth rates of Israeli Arabs, Palestinians in the West Bank, and Gaza, they will, in the very near future, perhaps as soon as 2020, outnumber Jews, so that if the two-state solution isn't reached by then, Israelis may face the awful choice, which Ehud Barak says they should never have to face, of being either Democratic or Jewish. In the larger picture, it's even more daunting. By 2050, the Jewish population, 2050 or 60, may grow to about 12 million. The number of Arabs will grow from the current 400 million to approximately 600 million, and the number of Muslims worldwide will grow from 1.7 billion to an estimated 3.5 billion. One in five persons on Earth now is Muslim. By 2060, one in three will. And that's a huge number, which operates against Israeli security and stability if the current difficulties continue. But an Israeli agreement with the Palestinians and normalization of relations with the Gulf Arabs would be a tremendous positive plus for both Israel, the Palestinians, and the other Arabs.
You were able to work things out in Ireland, and it's been argued that that's because that was only an 800-year-old problem, whereas
that's right.
The situation in Israel goes back
that did happen.
Much longer time.
I spoke at a large event at Hebrew University at the request of then President Peres. And I talked in a question-answer period. I answered about Northern Ireland. I said it was 800 years old. And when I came down from the stage, there's often a group of people gathered, someone to ask questions, get autographed books. And an elderly gentleman said to me, "Senator, did you say 800 years in Ireland?" I said, "Yes." And he repeated the number again, and then he kind of gave a dismissive wave of his arm. He said, he said, "No wonder you settled it. Such a recent argument." So this does go back many thousands of years. But I think the important thing is not to look back, but to look forward.
My guest is George J. Mitchell, the former U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace, former senator from Maine. His latest book, A Path to Peace, A Brief History of Israeli-Palestinian Negotiations and a Way Forward in the Middle East, written with Alon Sachar and published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation after this. We are back with George J. Mitchell, who, along with Alon Sachar, has written A Path to Peace, A Brief History of Israeli-Palestinian Negotiations, and A Way Forward in the Middle East. It is published by Simon & Schuster. The chief of city planning in Jerusalem has declared an end to a hold on Jewish housing in Arab neighborhoods in East Jerusalem. Hasn't the number of settlers in East Jerusalem and the West Bank increased considerably since Barack Obama took office in 2009?
Yes. Every American president since the settlement process began in the late 1960s has opposed Israel's policies on settlement and construction, and every Israeli prime minister has supported settlement construction in varying ways at varying paces. So there's nothing new about either. I'm not sure whether this will result in an explosion of new settlements. The 500 units announced were, in fact, the same 500 units that were announced in 2010 when Vice President Biden made his visit, and the announcement was made just as he landed, which was insulting to the Vice President and the President. But those are the same units that have been reannounced now. The process is very complicated, it's opaque, and it has announcements at several stages of each project, so it makes the appearance of even more than is the reality.
Recently, legislation was introduced in Israel to retroactively legalize settlements on privately owned Palestinian land.
Yes, that's a very controversial issue. For many years, some Israeli settlers have settled on private Palestinian land, what are called outposts, illegal under Israeli law. Each Israeli prime minister for the past couple of decades has promised the American president at the time that Israel would dismantle those outposts, and that hasn't happened.
Well, they did it in the Gaza Strip. Why couldn't they do it in the occupied territories?
Well, the Gaza Strip were not outposts. Those were settlement areas. They did unilaterally withdraw from those. There was opposition to it. It was traumatic for most Israelis to see that occur, and is one of the reasons why it would be very difficult to have large-scale evacuations from the West Bank. That's one of the reasons why U.S. policy suggests and supports land exchanges to keep within Israel some of the major settlements and reduce the number of settlers who would have to move once a Palestinian state were established.
American journalists often say something like, in the view of many experts, settlements violate international law. On what grounds can the settlements be seen as legal under international law? And in light of the Quartet's decision, the you mentioned earlier, U.S., right. EU, Russia, and the UN, which proposed a roadmap in 2002 and a freeze on the settlements.
Right. There's a vigorous legal dispute on that issue. There are many Israelis and many Americans who support Israel who argue that the settlements, the West Bank is disputed territory, not territory owned by Palestinians and not territory to be reserved for a Palestinian state. The latter position is one that is taken by the United States and by most countries in the world and most international institutions. The problem is that settlements are an important issue. Those who say it doesn't matter, in my judgment, are just plain wrong. But it is not the only issue. And you have to put it into the focus, into the context of the entire dispute. That's why it's so important, in my judgment, to get into negotiations, to establish boundaries. Once boundaries are established, Israel can build whatever they want within their boundary, and the Palestinians can build whatever they want within their boundary, and the issue is resolved.
Prime Minister Netanyahu imposed a moratorium on settlement construction in 2010. What did that amount to in practice?
it did amount to a substantial reduction in the number of new housing construction starts in the West Bank during that 10-month period. That is to say, as each building under construction was completed, a new one was not started. Had the moratorium been extended for a sufficient period of time, housing construction would have come to a complete halt on the West Bank.
We mentioned earlier that there's been less talk about coming up with a two-state solution to the problem. So what would a one-state solution mean?
It would be extremely difficult for both sides. Israel is a democratic state. Israel is a Jewish state. But if you had a single state in which the majority were non-Jewish, that is, were Palestinian or other Arab, how could you have one man, one vote, or one person, one vote? So Israel would have to choose between being a democratic state or a Jewish state. Former Prime Minister and Defense Minister Ehud Barak described that as the choice that the people of Israel should never have to make. And I agree with him. I think that one of the urgent reasons why I hope the president-elect here will adopt the two-state solution, not adopt, continue it. It's been our policy for a long time. Simply continue the policy. That's our objective.
How many years did you serve as special envoy to Northern Ireland under Bill Clinton?
Well, I chaired three separate sets of discussions in Northern Ireland over a span of 5 years, but only early in that period was I a U.S. Representative. When the negotiations began, the British and Irish governments insisted that I be completely independent. And so I severed all ties with the U.S. The British and Irish governments, for example, paid the salaries of my small staff. They offered me a salary. I rejected it because I wanted to be completely independent, but they paid my expenses. And so I was then officially not a representative of the U.S. government. I did maintain close contact with President Clinton on the subject, but the decisions I made were mine alone and those of my two colleagues in the job at the time.
Were there principles or approaches that you applied in Northern Ireland that you believed would work in the Middle East as well?
Every human being is different. Every society is different, and every conflict is different. There is no off-the-shelf formula that you can take and apply to any two conflicts. Each is unique. Each requires a specific, unique circumstance. But there are approaches that you can take, fairness, openness, a willingness to give each side an opportunity to speak. Try to get them to see the other not as an alien tribe, but as fellow human beings. I think all of those come into play, but the reality is, Leonard, that the situation in the Middle East is more complicated. Last year, I spoke to a large group of Irish Americans out in Queens, and I said to them, I'm going to say something I never thought I would believe, let alone say, and that is, I spent 5 years in Northern Ireland, then I went to the Middle East, and after 6 months in the Middle East, I thought the Israelis, dealing with Israelis and Arabs, the Irish were really easy and pleasant to deal with.
Well, you have a weird mixed heritage of your own, born of Irish parents but orphaned and brought up, adopted by a Lebanese family. So you have...
My father was an Irish orphan. Mm-hmm. My mother was born in Lebanon. And so I have both Irish and Lebanese heritage.
So yeah. You have a finger in both of these pots.
When I grew up, the whole process was assimilation in our country. So I think of myself as 100% American. And while I'm proud of my heritage on both sides, and my parents were, of course, the formative influences in my life, I think that our country, let me put it this way. I don't buy into the current talk of America in decline, the United States in decline at home and abroad. We are the dominant power in the world. We will be as far into the future as human beings can see. And despite our many serious imperfections, this United States of America remains the most open, free, and just society in the world.
When people are deeply divided, especially along lines that involve their sense of identity, how can minds be changed or divisions overcome? Do you just make a case for assimilation?
No, I think it's more making a case to opening your mind to others. it is true of you and I and almost every human being that our minds are wide open to views that are consistent with our prior beliefs, but quite closed to views that contradict our prior beliefs. And conflict produces several attitudes. The first is victimization. I've been deeply wronged. And what victimization does is that it liberates you from the standards that you would otherwise apply in a situation. That's a powerful factor operating in all of these conflict situations, Northern Ireland, the Balkans, the Middle East, and everywhere. The second is that, we still tend to stereotype. We still tend to have guilt by association groups. If a small group, a part of a group is bad, we stigmatize the whole group. I put it in terms of immigration. Jews were discriminated against severely for a long period of time in this country. Irish Americans, Italian Americans, Asian Americans, all based on group stereotyping. It's a part of human nature. You have to open up your mind first and then hopefully a heart to the views of others as human beings. Let them see each other not as a member of an alien tribe, but the common humanity that we have. That's how we should look at it.
Could Israel and Palestine use something like the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
I believe that was unique to South Africa, and it contained...
It has been tried elsewhere.
It has been tried elsewhere, but it contains a provision that people have to think long and hard about before they accept it, and that is the reason it got the information is it provided amnesty to those who testified. And when people get up under oath and say, I murdered X, Y, and Z, you get the truth, but you also get the relatives of X, Y, and Z who wonder why is that person going free. It's easy to say, but you have to think very carefully before you move forward in any specific situation. I don't think that's the time has yet arrived when that would make sense in Israel and the Palestinian territories.
There have been serious wildfires near Haifa recently, and Prime Minister Netanyahu has thanked Mahmoud Abbas for the Palestinian help in fighting the fires. How much do simple gestures like that help relations?
Well, they do help, particularly in this case, since the Israeli government has indicated that they believe that some of the fires were set, and presumably by Palestinians, as political statements. Obviously, it's reprehensible for someone to make a political statement by burning someone else's property and endangering other lives, so those actions should be condemned. I think that President Abbas did the right thing, a proper conciliatory gesture. There was an article in today's New York Times about two Palestinian men who built one of the restaurants owned and operated by an Israeli who helped fight the fire on it. So you have in each society some who will engage in violent acts against the other. And they should be condemned and deplored on both sides, and we should try very hard to lower the temperature, reduce and eliminate inflammatory statements, and try to create an atmosphere conducive to a meaningful negotiation.
But there is such a sense of tit-for-tat in all of the stories that we hear. Israel has destroyed Palestinian crops and olive groves in the past. So when one side does something, then the other side's crime is cited, and it goes back and forth, and you have the feeling you could go all the way back to the year 2000 BC.
That's right, and if you keep going, you may end up even further back and you won't take a step forward. The fact is that not every individual grievance can be satisfactorily resolved. But if we bury ourselves in the past, we are unable to move into the future. Someday someone has to say that's over and done with. We're looking forward. We're thinking about our children and grandchildren, not our grandparents.
You agreed to 2 years on the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, and then you write that when your 2 years ended, there had been no progress and there's no prospect for any. What were the biggest obstacles to progress? Was it the whole matter of people demanding that negotiations proceed without preconditions?
Well, that was part of it. I also said in my book, and this is personal speculation, that in order for these negotiations to succeed, the political leaders on both sides will have to take enormous political risks, indeed personal risks. They will do that only if they believe that there is a reasonable chance of negotiation succeeding. One of the problems now is that I believe Prime Minister Netanyahu doesn't think that President Abbas has the political or personal strength to enter into an agreement and to see that it's implemented. So he doesn't think the process is going to work because of the other guy, and so he doesn't want to make anything that looks like a concession that would subject him to harsh criticism in his own society. On the other side, Abbas does not believe that Prime Minister Netanyahu is serious. He thinks he doesn't really want a two-state solution, and he cites the fact that Prime Minister Netanyahu has been for and against a two-state solution, and that Abbas believes that Netanyahu does only so much that's needed to placate the United States. So both of them don't think it'll work, and they're unwilling to take risks to make it work. Someday someone's got to say it is a risk, but it's a risk that's in the interest of the people of my society. It's not a gift to the other side, and we're going to go ahead.
It's often been said that nothing can be accomplished without U.S. involvement, and yet the United States then is seen as taking sides anytime it takes a position.
Well, that's true, but the fact is that the United States' position is that the people of Israel have a successful state, which we are committed to defend, but they don't have security. They live in fear and anxiety from all kinds of attacks. You've just talked about fires and knifings and shootings and bombings. They're not going to get that security, I believe, until there is a Palestinian state, an independent, sovereign, non-militarized Palestinian state. From the other side, the Palestinians aren't going to get that state until the people of Israel have that sense of security, real and covering the future as well.
Should Hamas be included in any negotiations?
Not at the current time. They can come in if they accept the conditions set forth by the quartet, which, in my judgment, are fair and reasonable. First, that they recognize Israel. Second, that they forswear violence. And third, that they agree to accept prior agreements. Now, in Northern Ireland, the paramilitary on the nationalist side, Sinn Féin, the political party associated with the IRA, did not enter the talks until 16 months after they started. I was called upon and established what were called the Mitchell Principles, which governed admission to the talks, and they had to agree to certain things to get into the talks. They ultimately did, and they got into the talks, and we ended up with an agreement. So I think that for now Hamas isn't interested because it doesn't look like anything's happening. I think if you get the train moving out of the station and they think there's going to be progress, they might then rethink their opposition to these conditions.
And then everybody has to feel that once a two-state solution is achieved, that everybody will feel safe.
No, there'll be risks. There's a risk in a two-state solution, just as in every other course of action.
George J. Mitchell with Alon Zakhar, their book, A Path to Peace, published by Simon & Schuster.